The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers in the latest issue read out their pieces for you. Every Christmas, the Spectator's special edition contains more articles than usual, a triple edition, as it were. So this week, we've got more articles for you too. First up, it's Fraser Nelson reading out our leading article in the Christmas issue, with hopes that 2021 will be a year of renewal.
Save for those old enough to have lived through the Second World War and its immediate austere aftermath, it would be hard to remember a Christmas which felt less festive, or a new year that brings such foreboding. In spite of the severe restraints upon our lives, which have been in place for months now, it looks likely that we are going to see some kind of third wave of the virus, almost certainly with a third lockdown on its heels. And at the same time, Britain will be embarking on a Brexit adventure that many people still see as reckless and unwanted. But if we look just a little bit into the immediate future, things will appear brighter. Not just because of the vaccine, but because of what the crisis says about our values and expectations. We accepted these restrictions. Public opinion was always behind them. That's because we value life more nowadays. We all have come to expect to live longer, healthier lives. Think back half a century to the Hong Kong flu of 1968. That took more lives per capita than COVID has done so far. Life expectancy in the UK back then was 71.7 years. Now it's 81.4 years. So if COVID has struck half a century ago, there'll be far fewer 80-year-olds and 90-year-olds to protect. The fact that the average age of a COVID fatality was 82 did not one bit lessen the seriousness with which the virus has been treated right over Europe. Yes, lives were saved at a huge economic cost, but that cost may not prove to be permanent. The Office for Budget Responsibility recently produced two scenarios for next year, two kind of Christmas futures, if you like. The bleaker one sees Britain trapped in a cycle of lockdown and release, never quite getting ahead of the virus, and suffering permanent economic scarring as a result. But the best case scenario sees the vaccine ruled out quickly and the economy back on its feet by the summer. According to this version of the future, the country will soon end up no poorer than if the virus had never struck, with the economic damage entirely made good. Yes, the scenario is upbeat, but it's also entirely plausible. Until the second wave came along, the British economy was recovering far faster than anyone predicted, as a result of the resourcefulness, resilience and enterprise of the public. The pent-up demand was there from people who'd saved money during lockdown, and it's there still. People are looking for the signal not just to spend, but they're anxious to get out to support local businesses and start to repair their local communities and economies. We might not have long to wait. Professor Jonathan Van Tam, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, has observed that his priority list for vaccinations, the over-50s and certain at-risk groups, will cover 99% of those likely to die from the virus. So once this group has been covered in phase one, it gives the government an interesting choice. Should they keep locking down until the rest of the country has been vaccinated, or might it be safe to start resuming normal life as soon as those most at risk have been protected? Boris Johnson ought to be thinking very carefully about this right now, because it could be the most important question of next year. He should ask his officials to work out what the implications for the NHS would be if restrictions were lifted once the at-risk groups and the over-50s are protected. Now, this isn't an easy question. Certainly, as a third of those admitted to hospital with COVID right now are under the age of 65. This is a virus that certainly does affect the young. But so does lockdown, so does unemployment, and so does the educational mayhem. Then again, we've also got to consider the issue of long COVID, which affects young and old, and deserves much more serious attention than it has so far received. This is, as always has been, about a balance of risk. Now, the fact that Britain has been the first country to approve and start administering the Pfizer vaccine is a promising sign for our future outside the EU. It was never the case that the approval process was tied in with Brexit. The emergency powers always existed. But the fact that we actually chose to use them this time bodes well, because Brexit was, in and of itself, never going to transform Britain. It's simply the removal of a constraint. All that will depend next year, when we finally leave the EU, is how well or how badly the government uses this extra powers. So amid the uncertainty of what the new year holds, there is plenty of reason for hope. In Tennyson's poem, In Memorandum, he describes the new year bells as a sound of renewal. "Ring out the old shapes of foul disease," he writes. "Ring in the thousand years of peace." It might be too much to hope for a millennium of peace, but the foul disease that's blighted this year will certainly be rung out soon. This Christmas will be subdued. No carols, no busy congregations, and many of us may well choose to spend it alone. But nothing was ever going to cancel Christmas. We can still celebrate the arrival of light into the world, and next year the work of repair can begin.
That was Fraser Nelson. Next, we're going to hear from Matt Ridley on why mRNA vaccines could revolutionise medicine.
Almost 60 years ago, in February 1961, two teams of scientists stumbled on a discovery at the same time. Sidney Brenner in Cambridge and Jim Watson at Harvard independently spotted that genes send short-lived RNA copies of themselves to little machines called ribosomes, where they are translated into proteins. Sidney got most of the credit, but I don't mind. Watson sighed last week when I asked him about it. They had solved a puzzle that had held up genetics for almost a decade. The short-lived copies came to be called messenger RNAs, mRNAs, and suddenly they now promise a spectacular revolution in medicine. The first COVID-19 vaccine given to British people this month is not just a welcome breakthrough against a grim little enemy that has defied every other weapon we have tried, from hand-washing to remdesivir and lockdowns. It is also the harbinger of a new approach to medicine altogether. Synthetic messengers that reprogram our cells to mount an immune response to almost any invader, including perhaps cancer, can now be rapidly and cheaply made. Katalin Karikó, the Hungarian-born scientist who doggedly pursued the idea behind this kind of medication for decades at the University of Pennsylvania before joining BioNTech, and her collaborator Drew Weissman may be the Watson and Brenner of this story. They figured out 15 years ago how to send a message in a bubble into a cell and have it read. For years, they had tried putting in normal RNA and found it did not work. The body spotted it was an alien and destroyed it. But by subtly modifying one of the four letters in the message, replacing uridine with pseudouridine, a chemical found in some RNAs in the body anyway, they made a version that escaped the attention of the cell's MI5 agents. Further refinements 5 years ago produced a recipe that worked reliably when delivered to cells inside a tiny oily bubble. The pandemic is the first time the technique has been tried in anger, and it worked. The first two COVID vaccines, BioNTech's and Moderna's, rely on these messengers. The message tells the cell to make part of one of the virus proteins, which then alerts the body's immune system. Once invented, the thing is like a general-purpose vaccine. You simply rewrite the message between the same opening and closing sequences, put it in the same kind of bubble, and fire it off. Almost as easy for genetic engineers these days as writing a text is for teenagers. It's faster, cheaper, safer, and simpler than the old ways of making vaccines. More conventional vaccine designs may still make a vital contribution to defeating the pandemic, Oxford's included. And the messenger method has its drawbacks, such as the need for extreme cold storage. But in the long run, messengers probably represent the future of vaccines. Now the principle has been approved by regulators, there may be no need to go through the same laborious and expensive three-phase clinical trials every time. Faced with a truly lethal pandemic, with a 10% mortality rate, say, the vanishingly small likelihood that a new messenger vaccine would be unsafe pales into insignificance. You could deploy it in weeks or days. What is more, at the cost of a few billion dollars, the world may now be able to build a library of messenger vaccines for every plausible coronavirus and influenza virus with pandemic potential we can find. Test them in animals and store the recipes on a hard disk, ready to go at a moment's notice. Moderna's vaccine was first synthesized in mid-January, before we even knew the coronavirus was coming out of China. There are already improved variations on the messenger theme too, self-replicating messengers, for example. Vaccine development has long been the Cinderella of pharmaceuticals, and this would not have happened without the pandemic. But nor would it have happened without the 30-year scientific slog Dr. Carrico undertook. A fast, adaptable vaccine platform has long been the dream. Let's try it against hepatitis, Zika, and several kinds of common cold. We may begin to do to viruses what we've already done to most intestinal worms, many blood parasites, and not a few bacteria. Abolish them from the human experience. If the message is the recipe for a protein characteristic of particular tumours, the immune system may learn to mount a devastating attack on a cancer. How about Alzheimer's? There will be setbacks, side effects, and unintended consequences. There always are with innovation. There will be scares based on false fears spread by unscrupulous cranks. And already some worry that these vaccines might cause infertility. It's nonsense, but with just enough plausibility to alarm some people. Pregnancy depends on a gene called syncytin that causes cells to fuse in the placenta. Syncytin, bizarrely, appears to be derived from a virus our ancestors caught millions of years ago. The spike protein, target of the Pfizer vaccine, also causes cells to fuse in a similar way. It shares with syncytin a few short sequences of letters in its gene, but so do scores of other harmless proteins in our bodies, so the worry is baseless. One problem we will probably face, if this RNA dream comes true, is a rise in allergies, asthmas, and autoimmune problems. These are caused by the loss of parasites which used to suppress our immune systems. The more infections we get rid of, the more likely we are to have intolerant reactions to things like pollen and gluten. But then messenger vaccines may also be a way to tackle these and teach the immune system to behave. What if 2020 went down in history as the year synthetic biology dealt a mortal blow to future viruses and illnesses in general, rather than the year a virus ruined our health, well-being and livelihoods?
That was Matt Ridley. Next, Ian Rankin, the author, writes a short story for the Christmas issue, and here he is.
Ever since his daughter's death, John Bates had all but given up. Eunice had been 17, bubbly, surrounded by friends, keen to leave school behind to study history at university. She'd been a passionate cook and hockey player, not yet ready for a steady boyfriend, and loved absolutely by both her parents. But then one night, she had consumed almost an entire bottle of vodka before climbing onto a parapet and leaping into a river swollen by over a week of near constant rain. John and his wife Emily had sat numbed for days on end as relatives and neighbours passed through the house, offering solace and paying tribute. Now, 6 months on, Emily was back at work at the florist's, increasingly busy as Christmas approached. Breakfasts were quiet affairs, the radio saving them from talking. They watched TV each evening and sometimes walked to the local park, where they would see teenagers they didn't recognise, sharing spliffs and cans on benches, wrapped up more warmly as the weather turned. The shops had begun extending their hours, excepting the ones lost to the pandemic. A few media reports had suggested that Eunice's suicide had been in reaction to the virus, but Bates doubted that. Then again, she had left few clues. He had gone through her bedroom, even checking beneath the bed and at the back of the built-in wardrobes. He'd eventually gained access to her computer and mobile phone, the phone itself having been left on the parapet, proving itself the nearest thing to a note that she would leave. Counselling had been offered, but rejected, though John sometimes caught a glimpse of Emily's tablet as she digested some online resource for bereaved parents. He thought she even belonged to a group who met via Zoom, though she was careful never to mention it, the meetings timed to take place when he was elsewhere. He spent his afternoons in the reopened library or at a cafe or bar. He tried to catch up on his reading. He might get close to finishing the occasional cryptic crossword. It had been his job many years back to compile such crosswords for the local paper. That paper no longer existed. John had left anyway, Emily insisting that he should write full time. The result had been one radio sitcom, a handful of plays, and two well-received serial comic novels. One review had even compared him to Jonathan Coe. He'd hung on to that while binning most of the others. He had no commissions currently, his agent blaming, what else, the pandemic. A stage producer was keen for him to write a spec script based on a 1930s whodunit, but there would be no fee until an acceptable draft had been completed. His current book publisher appeared lukewarm, sales having not been commensurate with prize shortlistings. "Just start writing anything, darling," Emily had suggested one night, placing a hand on his shoulder. "You might find it helps. God knows, something has to." But could he produce anything that wouldn't be read through the prism of Eunice's death? Would anyone publishing him do so, as if handing over a belated deepest sympathy card? And what was worth writing about anyway? No one wanted comedy moulded from tragedy. Despite which, he had found himself this morning picking up his old leather-bound notebook, a gift from Emily after a trip to Venice, and walking to the cafe. After scanning the newspaper and ordering a second Americano, he had opened the notebook, skimming its pages. There were ideas for projects alongside character names and the odd smart one-liner, but outnumbered by doodles and crossings out. The last half of the book comprised blank pages, evidence that the creative well had been drying up long before Eunice took her life. Yet, as he ran a thumb through these empty pages, he caught a sudden blur of ink. The words were in a neat hand, blue ballpoint, rather than the black he favoured, and comprised a single sentence. "I live here now." He had no memory at all of writing them. Moreover, they didn't seem like his handwriting. He flicked back to check, then took out his biro and wrote the words for himself. Definitely not his handwriting. He scoured the rest of the notebook, then snapped it shut and got to his feet. Emily was busy at the counter, trimming the stems of a spray she was putting together with her usual skill. She didn't look up until he held the notebook open in front of her. "Did Eunice do this?" he asked, voice shaking. Emily slipped her glasses on. "Could be," she answered. "I mean, it looks like her writing, doesn't it? Does it, though? I'm not sure. She maybe did it to tease you, so you'd get a surprise when you reached that page." "Maybe," Bates said, pretending to agree. Remember, Peter and Barbara are coming for supper. You'll buy some wine, won't you? Their favoured off-licence was a few shops further along. Bates plucked a bottle of red from a shelf without really paying attention. There was a homeless man seated on the pavement next to the bank machine. Bates found a few coins in his pocket and bent at the waist to deposit them in the man's cardboard cup. He hadn't meant to establish eye contact, but it happened anyway. "Wife threw me out," the man explained. "Just need the price of a bed." "I'm sorry," Bates said, straightening up and making to walk on. "I live here now," the man called to him. Bates froze. "What did you say?" "This street, this pavement. I live here now, don't I?" That evening, as the meal ended and his old friend Peter stepped into the garden for a cigarette, Bates joined him, holding out the notebook, open at the relevant page. Peter took it, angling it into the light, widening his eyes in an attempt to focus after the best part of a bottle and a half of red. "I've looked at Eunice's handwriting," Bates told him. "It's similar, but not identical." "OK. What do you think it means?" "More to the point, what do you think it means?" Peter asked, falling back on his well-worn tactic when faced with a question he either didn't like or didn't understand. "I don't know," Bates said truthfully. "Is it a sign, perhaps? From Eunice?" Peter puffed out his cheeks. "Were practical jokes her thing? Or are you saying she's suddenly communicating with you 6 months after her very beautiful funeral?" "Much more likely you wrote it in your cups. A prospective new title or opening line. It's intriguing enough for either." Peter sucked in some smoke before exhaling. "Bloody nice meal, by the way. We must return the favour." "You always say that. And one of these days it shall come to pass. Though I warn you, Barbara's not half the chef your Emily is. Oh, I'm hoping there's enough pud for one final helping." Once their visitors had gone, John did the tidying up, while Emily stretched out along the sofa, the TV on and some leftover wine in her glass. He filled the dishwasher, wiped down the dining table, and put the good cotton napkins in the laundry basket. He had left the notebook open on his chair next to the sofa, hoping Emily might take another look and come up with an explanation that would put his mind at rest. When he went through, the notebook was on the floor next to her. He picked it up and saw that the page had been torn out. Emily pointed to the waste paper bin, its bottom covered in a layer of what could have been mistaken for confetti. "Now it'll stop bothering you," she snapped. "You were in such a bloody mood at dinner." "Why did you do that?" He lifted out a few slivers. They appeared to be all blank. There was no way the jigsaw could be reconstructed. "Forget about it, John. Time to move on with your life." "Life is not one of your sodding Zoom sessions," he snarled, heading to the hall, snatching up his coat and slamming the front door after him. The night was chilly, the sky clear, a few stars evident. He could see his breath in the air as he walked. How could she? It was an act of destruction, irreversible. He stuffed his fists into his pockets, his strides long and determined. At last, he came to a bar he knew and walked in, ordering a whiskey, gulping it down, seated at a table. The place wasn't busy. Bars seldom were these days. He ordered a refill and tried to concentrate on the TV. Its sound was muted, news and sport by the look of it. The on-screen Chiron was detailing a story about unrest in an African country. Then he saw the same four words, clear as day. "I live here now." He blinked, looked around to see if anyone else had noticed. The Chiron was back to reporting the Africa story, but he would swear he wasn't mistaken. He watched and waited as a new story appeared, and another after that, then a break for adverts. One advert was for a new Hollywood release, its male and female stars, big names. Emily had mentioned it as a possible night out. After a few clips from the film, its title appeared, filling the screen. I Live Here Now. Bates leapt to his feet, one hand on the table to steady himself. The advert had ended, replaced by one for yogurt. He took out his phone from his pocket and tapped in the names of the two leads. He was taken to a website for their latest release. I Love Her Now. Bates expelled a bark of laughter. The barman asked him if everything was all right. Bates just shook his head, finished his second drink, and left. He made towards the bank machine, but the homeless man was no longer there. The florist's shop was in darkness too. Traffic was light. It was a weeknight, keeping the town centre quiet. The local art house cinema was advertising a French film. Bates stared at the poster for the best part of a minute, daring it to change. Eventually he moved on, knowing his ultimate destination now. The river. The bridge. The parapet. No one was waiting for him there, just a few padlocks left by superstitious lovers. Eunice's friends had stopped leaving posies, though he knew they had plans to raise money for a plaque. As he stood there, staring down at the rippling water beneath, he sensed her phone resting near his left hand. He reached out, but felt nothing. Nothing at all. He raised his own phone, its screen blank, and stared at it, willing something, anything, to happen, willing the world around him to acknowledge his unceasing agony. Less than a minute later, he hit the water, almost losing consciousness in the fall. The sharp iciness had him flailing at first, but then he relaxed, safe in the knowledge that the water was buoying him up. He saw the buildings above him change, town becoming suburb, before petering out to a smattering of industrial units with high walls and fences, beyond which lay motorway, rolling hills, and farmland. He had no idea how much time had passed by the time he clawed his way up a shallow bank. He staggered at first, but soon regained his balance, his clothes shivering, his shoes squelching. The plod home through deserted streets took numbing hours. The door was unlocked, so he let himself in, stripping in the hallway, climbing the stairs to where she waited for him. Not the master bedroom, but Eunice's bedroom. He lay down on her bed and closed his eyes. A shadow loomed over him. It was Emily. She looked fearful as she asked him what had happened. When he opened his mouth, it felt full of silt.
I live here now,
he gurgled, beginning with painful slowness to sit up.
That was Ian Rankin. And finally, Cressida Bonus, the actress, writes about her lockdown wedding in a notebook for the issue.
I had a lockdown wedding. A 30-person, socially distanced, sanitised church service was organised in under 2 weeks. Restrictions meant no hymns, no wind instruments, and no speaking too loudly. A disappointment for a musical family. Not what we'd envisaged, but a more intimate and special day than we could ever have imagined. Imperfect, yet perfect. A day we will never forget. 4 days before the big day, I marched up and down Oxford Street on the hunt for a wedding dress. Finding nothing, I remembered an old Whistles dress I once wore for a James Arthur music video. I went home and found the dusty frock at the back of my cupboard. After some ironing, it looked good as new. 2 days before the wedding, I woke up with a sty on my eyelid. It was red, bulbous, and seemed to be growing. My mum recommended the old-fashioned golden eye ointment. That only made it worse. The doctor said it would need operating on after the wedding. Not ideal timing, I thought. Well, it could be worse, the doctor said. How, I wondered. The night before the wedding, I stayed in a hotel with my family and my maid of honour. I went to bed with a cucumber compress on my eye. Morning arrived and we got lost on our way to the church. A supposedly 20-minute journey took an hour. We drove up and down a dual carriageway several times before eventually arriving at the church 40 minutes late. My dad seemed strangely quiet and I asked him if he was all right. He said, "It's just like taking Sheba, his dog, to the vet." He didn't want to do it, but knew he had to. He's very fond of my husband, Harry, by the way, but he didn't want to let his daughter go. I stepped out of the car and into a puddle. My sister Isabella told me not to worry, saying, "The rain is a gift," as I looked up to the heavens. People always say, "Oh, you don't notice wet weather on your wedding day." With strong winds and horizontal rain, I definitely did. But as the old saying goes, a wet knot is harder to untie. We were greeted by the vicar. This was her first lockdown wedding and she looked nervous. All the men wore summer suits, apart from my dad, who insisted on wearing his tailcoat. I chose not to fight that particular battle. As Harry and I both have abnormally large families, 22 siblings and 4 sets of parents between us, it was impossible for them all to be there. But the whole time I just wished that they were. This was the only sad part of an otherwise happy day. I am certain we value our family and friends even more when they are absent. My dad and I walked slowly up the aisle. At one point it looked as if we might never get to the altar. I gave his arm a squeeze. I couldn't look at his watery eyes. I knew it would set me off. Apparently, there's nothing worse than a blubbing bride. Then I saw Harry's face and everything fell into place. The COVID regulations, the uncertainty, the plans that got turned upside down, all were gone when I took Harry's hand. The service was moving despite the lack of hymns. There was a feeling that everyone was fully engaged in it. With big weddings, I often find this isn't the case. Hymns were replaced with readings and some beautiful piano playing by Harry's and my siblings. The keyboard was dutifully wiped and sanitized between each performance. Our mums read from Desiderata. My aunt recently passed away, and this was her favourite poem. It hung on the wall in her kitchen, and every day she would be reminded to go placidly amid the noise and the haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. Before we knew we were having a COVID wedding, we talk about the party, the guest list, the cake, people's expectations, what it should or shouldn't look like. Having a small portion of Harry's and my family in the church made it just simply special. After the service, swapping heels for trainers, we rode away on horses. At first, my horse looked at me nervously. He didn't seem keen on my dress. Once finally aloft, with hearts full, we rode off into the stormy weather and into our future life.
That was Cressida Bonus. Thanks so much for listening to this final episode of Spectator Out Loud of 2020. We hope you have a very happy Christmas and look forward to welcoming you back in the new year.